Good Morning Pensacola. Andrew McKay and the Pensacola Morning News starts right now.
In the state of Florida, and the state of Florida as a whole had just under $97 billion of economic generation for our military. Northwest Florida provided $22 billion worth of economic activity in 2022. Now, that is the largest contribution of all eight regions in the state.
Very interesting. A military forum that was put together in Santa Rosa County recently that had three congressmen, had the commanding officers or the XOs of all of our local bases, had all kinds of interesting information. It was designed to be a kind of a get people up to speed who might not be familiar with the various roles, functions, value, impact of the military installations. And, you know, what are some of the key problems that are facing our military here, because they're obviously such a massive part of our economy. This is Kay Rasmussen with the Florida Defense Network and our Florida Defense Task Force talking about the economic activity locally. Again, very interesting. You have, you know, across the state, $97 billion, but in Northwest Florida alone, nearly, well, more than a fifth of that in our region, out of all of these different regions, eight regions in 2022. And, you know, it's obviously gotten larger since then.
In addition, we have another benefit to our region as a result of our military, and that's defense contractors. So private sector businesses want to be around military installations so that they can do mission sets with them, contract to support their missions, and they create jobs. And they also help generate wealth within the community.
Yes, because, I mean, as we all know, you can make a pretty penny if you work in related industries to the defense industry. But look, if you've got lots of money coming into our economy in Northwest Florida from, you know, direct spending on military because the personnel get their paychecks and then they buy things at the grocery store, or, you know, they buy entertainment or whatever. They rent houses, or they, you know, rent apartments, or they buy houses. They buy cars, all that kind of stuff. But you also have the indirect thing of, if you're, you know, military adjacent, if you can somehow capitalize on that, which many do, that's really beneficial. And also the amount there, not quite the same as the $22 billion in direct spend, but the indirect spend.
So defense contractors in Northwest Florida in 2023, in the Congressional District 1, the value, monetary value from defense contracting in Florida District 1 in 2023 was $2.2
billion. $2.2 billion for people who work with the military somehow or other in Northwest Florida. So, that, again, that's our, you know, that's Eglin, that's Hurlburt, that's NES Whiting Field, that's, you know, NAS Pensacola, obviously, and Corey Station, which is a portion of NAS Pensacola or under the domain, you know, the command of NAS Pensacola. But I say this in a, like, but unfortunately, which is more a matter of opportunity, where do you think most of that money is spent?
And in Okaloosa County, the defense contracting provided 85% of that total $2.2 billion for congressional district run, and it was measured at over $1.9 billion.
So the vast majority of that defense contractor money is actually not spent. You know, you might think, because look, you know, we hear a lot about NES Pensacola, we hear a lot about Whiting Field, but Eglin and Hurlburt are, you know, and particularly Hurlburt is engaged in active military operations all the time. I mean, it's the home of the 1st Special Operations Wing. You know, it's the home of the Air Force Special Operations Command. And, you know, I mean, it's a major operational base. Not that NES Pensacola is not, but and not to offend Captain Chandra Newman, who actually said a comment. She's like, don't ever tell me that, you know, NES Pensacola is just a training base. Well, it's not just a training base, but it is primarily a training base. And that means that the force that comes to the Navy comes through NAS Pensacola. So actually, I'll play the clip by her in just a second. It's kind of a funny one. But, and you know, and Eglin has the test wing, obviously, 96th, and a lot of other function as well. But, I mean, Hurlburt is, you know, deployed. I mean, Hurlburt is putting bombs and bullets downrange every day in more than 20 countries. You might not think of it because if you don't drive by there at the right time of day, but, you know, they're putting the gunships out. They're putting the remote-operated vehicles. They're not really drones, okay? You know, they're sending not as much Ospreys now, but still, you know, Ospreys depart from there. Anyway, so the only reason I wanted to bring this point up is because if there's $2.2 billion spent on adjacent, you know, defense contracting, and the vast majority of it is in Okaloosa County, attached to the innovation being done at Eglin and the testing of new weapons at Eglin and attached to the military operations at Hurlburt, it's an opportunity. And one of the long-standing ideas about NAS Pensacola in particular, because Whiting is, there might be opportunities there. And look, you've got the Leonardo, you know, facility coming in there. And certainly that would be an expansion that would qualify in this sort of military adjacent element. But the longstanding theory about NAS Pensacola is that more could be done near the base if the infrastructure were right. If you had, for example, sewer instead of having only, you know, septic systems. If you had, you know, better IT in the region. If you had, you know, just different, if you had better power. I mean, kind of all the infrastructure stuff. If it were better, and also, you know, what Mike Kohler has been working on is beautifying the, you know, front gate, which means that, you know, more businesses might be inclined to build in that area or might find it desirable. There's a whole host of things, but it's an opportunity. It's an opportunity, in my opinion, to develop more things at NAS Pensacola instead of getting really a tiny slice of that whole, you know, defense contractor spend, as you heard her say, about $300 million out of a $2.2 million total. I said I would play Shauna Newman's comments. This was actually not funny, haha, but just, you know, it was an interesting way to hear her say it, that, you know, we're not just a training base here.
When people say that Naval Air Station Pensacola and Corry Station is just a training base, that is a very quick way to boil my blood. We are not just a training base. We are 60% of the force generation for your United States Navy, for your United States Marine Corps. So anything that flies, maintains, operates, and puts kinetics downrange that is on a wing, and yes, I'm a helicopter pilot, those rotors are wings, it all starts at Naval Air Station Pensacola. Anything that senses or makes sense of the electromagnetic spectrum, the cyberspace and space-based assets and cryptology and everything else is at Naval Air Station Pensacola.
Yeah, and she's not, I mean, of course, she's exactly right. You know, I don't ever think of it as a disparagement to say a training base. And there are things beyond just training that go on NAS Pensacola, but it is largely a training facility, but there's nothing incompatible between that and recognizing that 60% of our force production comes from there, which is, of course, true, at one point or another. And all of your air, right, starts there. And I love, you know, of course, most people don't think about a helicopter as being a winged aircraft, but it is. It's just those wings work weird. You know, they're very, very different operationally than the fixed wing, right? But, you know, the production of pilots and maintainers and a whole host of other things, as we did in the Tenix Command, you know, last year, trying to explain how many different things actually come from there. In fact, it's a massive operation at NAS Pensacola.
Across the installation, this is kind of the installation by the numbers, and given that we have a short frame of time, I don't want to anchor too much down on it. But we are a national landmark. We have 199-year-old problems, and this base ain't one. But, yeah, thank you. Appreciate that. But it's 199-year-old infrastructure that is obviously hurricane-prone and everything that goes on. And no offense to the general and his 27 commands, I think it was. We have 126 in all the joint forces. Now, he has 130,000 miles of range. I only have 18,000. Square miles of range.
It's funny when a captain in the Navy is a little bit thrown shade at a one star from the Army, from the Air Force, the commanding officer at Eglin. But you know, they both have tremendous impact, right? And Eglin is not nearly as old as NES Pensacola. Yeah, coming up on the 200th anniversary of NES Pensacola in some facility or another, and still damaged from Sally. Remember, just, you know, if you ever wonder, you know, what relationship hurricane damage has to our bases here locally, just look at the price tag. You know, $500 million in damage to NES Pensacola that is still, to this day, not been completely repaired. Obviously, massive amounts of repair still necessary to be done. But, you know, NES Pensacola is also not just, and I don't know how many times we have to tell you, but people don't know, and that's why we keep saying it, is not just the place where the Blue Angels are and where the museum is at and where pilots begin and where backseaters do a lot of their training. It's not just that. It is a massive operation with all kinds of elements, including, as she said, over the 100 tenant commands and every branch of the military.
But for everything that we do in at Naval Air Station Pensacola, your entire Joint Force plus Department of Homeland Security is represented with the Coast Guard and CISA, as well as everything in the U.S. Air Force's weapon systems operators and training, anything in aviation for the Navy, the Marine Corps, and the Coast Guard, anything in the information warfare domain and electromagnetic spectrum, which includes our Space Force and Army warriors and civil affairs for the Army as well. So it is a broad spectrum, including a Tier 1 mission that we actually have on Pensacola. And one of the best things that I like to say is that we are one of four installations in the entire continental United States with an airfield and a deep water port located, and the only one in the Gulf of America.
And I would say, frankly, both of those assets underutilized. Both the airfield, you know, is underutilized compared to, for example, how Whiting's is used. And the port is certainly underutilized, but that's something that we're, you know, trying to remedy a little bit.
Everything that comes out of boot camp and your acquisition or your accessions from the Academy and ROTCs and OCS all calls Naval Air Station Pensacola their first home outside of their accession source. We kill bad guys and we save good guys. That is our job and how we train your fleet.
Absolutely. And on that matter of the port and the Coast Guard mission, which I will be honest, as many years as I have been tracking NES Pensacola, if you ask me on any given day, how many Coast Guard cutters we got? I don't know anymore. it was one for a long time, the Cypress, which sits center point at the, you know, NES Pensacola, at the Beach Air Show. That's the Black Hall, the buoy tender that, you know, cleans up, you know, and maintains the buoy system around the area. But then they added a whole bunch of cutters, you know, the interdiction cutters, those are the White Hulls, and it was up to five at one point. I think two or three of those have now retired, so we're back down to like three or four, but it's going to go back up to six, I think.
I can reiterate this, but the other piece that is absolutely vitally important to know is because of that deep water port, Department of Homeland Security has U.S. Coast Guard cutters here. We have two cutters and a buoy tender. Funding was just elevated just a few weeks ago, and they're looking to bring our Bravo Pier back around to double our hulls to six Coast Guard cutters, which would actually get after some of our national interests when it comes to counter-narcotics and illegal immigration.
So she says we're at three now, which is two cutters and the buoy tender, and then we're going to go back up to six, which would be three additional over time. I don't know. I guess those would be the new ones, but that seems long off in the future, and the work on the port to improve its capability, I mean, I'm all for that. That would certainly seem to fall in line with the, you know, national directive on enhancing shipbuilding, ship maintaining, and ship. Yeah, you know, I mean, we have a deep water port. It's been neglected for a long time. At least portions of it have. Talking about partnership, one of the themes of this event, this whole forum, whatever you want to call it, was about partnership between the military and the civilian. And in Escambia County, and we've talked about this, you have this massive project of the Living Shoreline, including the White Island Renourishment on the east side, but massive project of, you know, protecting NAS Pensacola from water events, which have historically been a big issue.
I hope we get an opportunity to talk more about our partnership with Escambia County and the Living Shoreline for our flooding and a resiliency of our natural shore. And then again, you know, you get the side benefits of habitats and things of that nature, but how we create resiliency on the base. Part of that is that up until, this year breaking ground, but an effort that you championed is that Naval Air Station Pensacola has had one power line and one substation to the base for a single point critical failure for our mission for, 199 years.
Yeah, like before there was electricity. So there was no electricity, and then there was one line, and there's still one line, and there's still one line. And, you know, they've been working on enhancing that, and I don't think they're there yet. But And she was talking, you there was talking to Tim Kinsella, Lucky, the former CEO of the Bay. Well, two CEOs ago, you had Village in between. But he's, you know, obviously now the assistant city or the city administrator for Pensacola. Lucky is. Anyway, back to her comments about, again, that second power source.
Hurricane Sally has provided a lot of leverage, and a lot of that was to your work, too, to create a secondary power line and substation so we never lose criticality of our Tier 1 mission, let alone the forced generation for your fleet. And so this is something that is absolutely critical, but it might not be fresh paint on a building that somebody sees.
Yeah, you may not see the effect of developing a redundant power source for the base, but I mean, kind of an important thing, especially given the flood-prone and, you know, hurricane-prone vulnerability. So she kind of wrapped up with the repeat of the 60%, but it's a good bumper sticker.
So if there's anything that I just need a bumper sticker for Naval Air Station, Pensacola, Corry Station, and our outlying properties, is that we are 60% of your fleet's force generation. That is an operational mindset to get after why this is critical and why the relationships with the community and all the efforts that we need that are absolutely compatible with the city, the county, and our local area is vital to the successes of our service members and our families. So 60% of your force generation is here. We build warfighters, and that is absolutely a no-fail mission for the success of our nation.
And it's a reminder, because other parts of this conversation were, I thought, particularly interesting, talking about how if you really want to help the community, you help the military families. Because if you're helping the military families, as in if you're helping military kids, if you're helping with housing, if you're helping with mental health issues, if you're and treatment, if you're helping with childcare, and you're solving traffic problems, you are solving the community problems. And they are most acutely felt amongst the military families. So if you are solving the major problems that military families encounter, education, then you will be solving the problems of the community. And if you are solving the problems of the community, you will be making the bases safe from, for example, a base realignment and closure. But you're also going to be making your community strong. And so thinking of how strong families, strong housing and education, all the rest, translate into strong communities and also strong bases that produce, for example, 60% of our force structure in the Navy, you can see how it all ties together. And that was, I think, the point of this whole conference, is to get people to think more globally about the interconnection of some of these issues.
Good morning, Pensacola. Andrew McKay and the Pensacola Morning News starts right now.
Whoa.
All right, so our mission at the 96th Test Wing is really twofold. We have our test mission, which you can categorize with that test that Kay mentioned, talking about weapon systems and cyber capabilities that we develop and we get out to the warfighter. And we also provide range and installation support for all of those other entities. We've got about 44 different entities at Eglin Air Force Base.
So this is a Brigadier General. That's a one-star in the Air Force. Brigadier General Mark Massaro talking about the role at Eglin. This was part of a military forum that Santa Rosa County had that was very interesting, having representatives of all the local military bases. Three congressmen were here in town to talk about this. I mean, this is really, this is a big deal. This is like 5 or 6 hours long. It was very long. And I've listened to all of it. Very interesting stuff, by the way. A lot of it was just update briefs on what the missions are, which, of course, I found fascinating because as much as I do know about Hurlburt and Eglin, I still don't know enough. So hearing the one-star talk about that, you know, and one thing that's kind of interesting is his role at the base. He wears three hats, which is, I thought the structure of it was interesting.
As the commander, I have to wear three different hats. So I manage the 96th Test Wing's mission from a developmental test perspective, which is a massive mission in and of itself. I manage all of the host installation support. So everything from all the airspace that was mentioned, 123,000 square miles over the Gulf, but we also have 726 square miles of range space on land. And when you add up that airspace, it's about 134,000 square miles total. So all of that is wrapped up In the range operating authority hat as well.
And to me, what's interesting about this is that, you know, like at NES Pensacola, Captain Chandra Newman Mamasan, she is the mayor of the base, like, and also of Corey Station, because Corey is a subsidiary entity of NES Pensacola. And so she handles all of the base issues, security and infrastructure and, you know, tenant complaints or tenant relations. You know, there's over 100 tenant commands, you know, all of that stuff. But she doesn't have the command aside from that. And he's saying, I kind of do three things. Number one is I run the 96th test wing, which is a unique operational command. And then also he handles all the base tenant relations and then managing the airspace in the Gulf and then also the land and the airspace on land. And, you know, I mean, it's a pretty massive footprint, right, when you think about it, that whole range. And if you're unfamiliar, and I know for a lot of you, you know this, and a lot of you don't. You might be new to town or new to the show or you just don't know. I'm trying to think of the exact shape, the way to describe this. If you drew a line, I'm going to get this wrong, but it's going to be close. If you drew a line from Navarre south by southeast down to, God, I think it goes almost to like Key West and then east and then a rectangle back up to like Tallahassee, that's all Eglin airspace, like 123,000 square miles. It's a huge airspace. So the basically the eastern end of the Gulf is all belongs to Eglin. Don't say it, John. Anyway,
I just want to understand
the Gulf of Mexico.
No. I wasn't worried about that.
Okay.
I was so Eglin, if they have to scramble military, the Air Force, they cover that area? Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that if you enter that airspace, like that's their test range. That's where they that's where they shoot things and fly things and you know, blow things up and drop and whatever. I have to look up the map of this because I may be a little off in my description of it, but it's something like that. It's pretty,
that's
and
huge.
It's a massive airspace off the water. So what does Eglin do?
How I like to look at Eglin Air Force Base and how I want to communicate it is we're a power projection platform. So everything that we do there transmits power from a national instrument of power through the military lens for our decision makers, for our national security apparatus, to be able to communicate that on a global stage.
Absolutely. And by the way, I did check real quick. I had it exactly right. It's if you drew a line, it's more directly south, actually. If you draw the line south off of, basically almost Alabama, and then there's some of it that belongs to the Navy as well, but then you go at past Key West, all of that range, just that whole area. Anyway. Eglin is a force projection capability. It is a power projection platform.
A test and range mission perspective, we're all focused in on readiness and lethality. The 96th test wing, as I said, we test and develop weapons. There's nothing more lethal than weapons out there. And that's our focus in the 96th test wing. And we provide those weapons to our warfighters. We make sure that our partners here just across the ramp at Hurlburt Field, the folks that are getting trained here at NAS Pensacola are going to go to their platforms and are going to have weapons that work so that we can deter our enemies from taking action that we don't want them to take. That's the whole point.
And kill them if they can't be deterred, right? But, of course, that's implicit in the deterrence. But, yeah, that's why you have, like, the Armaments Museum. That's a large portion of what Eglin does, that 96th test wing, where they build weapons from the ground up.
You can see some of the other numbers that we've got there. 20,000 is just how many people come on and off base to do their work. 10,000 of those are within the 96th test wing.
So about half is the test wing. The other half is other things.
And then from a medical perspective, one of the other key things at Eglin Air Force Base is our hospital. They provide a lot of medical support for our veterans, for our extended military dependents, and other folks who have access to the base for medical care. So 120,000 people come on and off base for various services, and a large part that medical treatment facility there is a key piece of that.
And since this is outside of our listening area goes to basically the Okaloosa County line, that's why I find it interesting is we haven't done a lot with Eglin. I mean, I'm aware, but we don't, do a lot of stuff with them because they're outside of our listening area. But obviously, majorly important employer and source of funds and economic development for our entire area. And with Hurlburt being a little closer, which is a completely separate entity, but still, Air Force, right? John, back to the presentation at the military forum in Santa Rosa County by Mark Massaro, General Mark Massaro, the One Star, who is in charge of Eglin and the 96th Test Wing. And this part's going to go really fast. Like, he's going to say a lot of things really fast, but pay attention, because if you want to get a sense of the scope of operations at Eglin.
So when I talked about Team Eglin having 44 mission partners, this slide does not show all 44 patches. We have four actual Air Force wings, so the 96th test wing being the primary one. We have a couple others that are listed on here, the 53rd wing, 350th, and two special operations wings on the reserve component as well. And we also train on the F-35, so the 33rd fighter wing is a big training wing there. I'll get a little bit more into them. But those are talking about the Air Force wings. We also have other organizations that are out there that are part of the joint force that are wing equivalent as well. 7th Special Forces Group Airborne is a big partner for us on the range. They have Camp Bull Simons. They do a lot of training there, and they deploy for operations from the range.
So 7th Special Forces Group, F-35, 33rd Fighter Wing, that's another major component there. The 350th, the the 96th, the 53rd, like it's, you know, pretty big operation.
When you look at military instrument of power, we develop technology that doesn't exist. We have to figure out what is out there that we can take advantage of, that we can have an advantage of over our adversaries. And in this world of competitive environment that we're at, where our adversaries are peer or near peer to us, we have to maintain that advantage. We have to constantly be seeking out that new technology that doesn't exist. We have an Air Force Research Laboratory at Eglin Air Force Base that does just that.
We build things that don't exist.
We do developmental testing, which is that really early testing to test that new technology, to work with the developers industry to make sure that things come out. We also have operational testing, which is more how effective and suitable is it for the warfighter, and can we develop the tactics that we need to use in combat for that? And we've got that going on every single day. We also have another patch on there, AFOTEC, Air Force Operational Test and Evaluation Center. So all the testing enterprise for the entirety of the Air Force is represented in some way at Eglin. We train, I mentioned the 33rd Fighter Wing with the F-35s. We also have the 6th Ranger Training Battalion, where they do their jungle training up in the northeast corner.
Yeah, and because, again, Eglin is a massive footprint, both in land and then on the Gulf. Obviously, it's an enormous footprint in the Gulf. One thing, just a little, this is a small thing. I actually happen to know this one, but I still think it's always fun. It's fun to hear about it. You ever go over the bridge? Oh, which bridge is this? I forget now. But you get into Fort Walton Beach, and you see the big hotel, and there's a giant beach ball. Looks like the top half of the Pensacola Water Tower beach ball sitting on top of a hotel. Have you seen that, John? Do you know what that is?
Yes.
Okay, all right. But you know what it does?
What?
No, okay.
Is it a radar?
The things you've probably seen on the beach when you're driving down through Fort Walton Beach is the one with the giant beach ball on the top of the hotel. That beach ball is actually one of our telemetry radar antennas that helps us with our range activity. So you can see how that partnership works, and that's on one of the enhanced use leases as an example.
Oh, by the way.
I'll never look at it the same again, my friend.
Right, and it's a perfect location for them.
Oh, it is,
it's
yeah.
Sort of, you know, aesthetically nice, and, you know, it serves as part of the public-private partnership that operates between them and Fort Walton and the hotel. But, you know, just little things you never know, and now you know. You can't drive past it without thinking about it. And then the last piece, and this to me was, of all the numbers and the scope and the variety of the missions at Eglin, this was the one that I had not considered, like didn't realize how important Eglin is to our warfighting mission right now because of its basic amphibious nature. Eglin is a land, water, joint, surface base. You don't maybe think of it that way. You're like, why does that matter? Well, let me tell you, or let the general tell you.
The primary area that we focus all of our development right now and all of the national strategy is based on China. And what's critical about that and how it relates to what we're doing here and why it's so critical that we have access to these resources here, there's a lot of water and there's water to land transitions. And that's a lot different than what we've been dealing with for the last 30 plus years. So the Gulf land transition into the range is a key component and a critical asset that we have here and one that we try to protect critically.
Land to water transition for testing, and, you know, I don't want to say something that's inaccurate, but if you're testing, for example, in the electromagnetic spectrum, if you're testing for detectability, if you're testing for operational capabilities of weapons to traverse a marine to land environment or barrier because somebody might have, say, I don't know, defensive radars. You need to be able to test things across that topography. So having that topography is important, right? And if you think about what might be coming with regards to China, it's going to be water to land transition across all the islands in the South Pacific, or in the China Sea area, in dealing with China, if we ever have to deal with them. I mean, it makes sense. And I had never thought about it that way. And he's like, oh, by the way, China. Oh, yeah, that makes sense. All right, so there'll be more about this. In fact, next hour we're going to talk about Hurlburt, which I thought was particularly interesting. Not just their mission, but some of the issues facing Hurlburt, which are substantial, okay, right now. We'll talk about that again next hour.
Good morning, Pensacola. Andrew McKay and the Pensacola Morning News starts right now.
Well, bless my soul, but what's wrong with me? I'm itching like a man on a fuzzy tree. My friends say I'm acting wild as a bug. I'm in love. I'm all shook up.
Okay, first I do want to throw a caveat. If I sneeze up here or my voice gives out, I had an engagement with cats a couple days ago. I'm not afraid of terrorists. They're just targets. But a room full of cats will take me out. So if my voice gives out or I sneeze, I'm just feeling some residual effects of visiting a friend with cats.
I'm not afraid of terrorists. They're just targets. But a cat will take me down. This is Colonel Patrick Deering. He is the commanding officer of the 1st South, 1st Special Operations Wing at Hurlburt Field. He is not the CO of the base, but he was another one of the participants in this very interesting, it was really an economic development forum of sorts because it was put on by Shannon Ogletree and the economic development folks in Santa Rosa County to try to help people understand the significance of the military mission and what challenges they face and how functioning within and around them is important for economic development. But it was really a military forum, and, you know, three congressmen were there. I mean, Jim Petronis was there and a couple of others were also there, one from Texas. It was very cool. And then they had, like I said, representatives of the major installations, the four major installations in our close vicinity, Eglin, Hurlburt, Whiting, and NES Pensacola. Corey's a subsidiary of NES Pensacola. Anyway, so Patrick Deering talking about the mission at Hurlburt, which I knew this one a little bit better because I had done a tour there recently. Not recently, like 9 years ago, 10 years ago. But, you know, still, I mean, I always think about it because what they do is amazing. But again, things change, information changes, and what they do is, I mean, frankly, amazing. And I don't think a lot of the news gets out about any of the military bases and what they do, but particularly our Air Force bases in the close vicinity.
So at Hurlburt Field, we're the home of Air Force Special Operations Command. We're the home of 1 SAL, that's my wing, 1st Special Operations Wing. And like Eglin, we have a ton of tenant partners. We have 40 tenant units at Hurlburt Field. What grew out of a very small auxiliary field when Rick flew with Orville and Wilbur many years ago, it has grown into a base of 23,000 people, third, fourth largest base in the Air Force when it comes to people. Very small geographically, unlike Eglin. Eglin has a huge range and a lot of land. We have very little land, but we have a ton of people.
23,000 people at Hurlburt. 23,000. I don't know. I always think of Hurlburt as small because, you know, it's small. I mean, geographically, it's small. It's not Eglin, okay? It's not NES Pensacola. It's a teeny tiny little place. 23,000 people. That is, wow. Holy smokes.
At Hurlburt Field 1 South, the mission comes first. If you see a mission on the news that says Special Operations Forces took out terrorist X, there's a good chance 1 SAL was there that night. There's a great chance we were involved. We're not going to talk about it. We won't address it. That terrorist will just be eliminated.
Yeah, so it's like a lot of things we do. You know, you don't hear a lot of press releases out of Corey Station. You know, you don't, because of what they do is largely stuff you don't want to publicize. You know, what we do out of Hurlburt, you don't see a lot of press releases because we just want to go over, kill them, come back. You know, that's the idea, okay? But it is massively important operation.
My boss, General Conley, commander of AFSOC, he wears two hats.
That's and Air Force he Special is the Operations
soft
Command.
Component.
For, and by the way, soft there are Special Operations Forces, not soft like hard, but soft Special Operations Forces.
Soft component for the Air Force, and he is the air component for U.S. SOCOM. And so not only are we airmen, we're also special operators, and we work hand-in-hand with our SEAL partner, SEAL partners, Green Berets, Rangers, MARSOC Raiders, and these soft truths are really the tenets that we try to live by in addition to our Air Force core values.
Absolutely.
A couple things I do want to hit. Number one, people more important than hardware. As General Massaro mentioned, you know, the development of our airmen, taking care of our families, that's as important as the next widget or the next airplane we're going to buy.
And that's a key component, is realizing, I mean, Eglin is making the things, but Hurlburt is deploying the people that use the things, and understanding that the people are more important and certainly as important as the widgets or devices that they're creating. So what exactly comes out of Hurlburt? Colonel Patrick Deering, the commanding officer of the 1st Special Operations Wing, 1st SOW on board, they wouldn't say on board, sorry, the Navy people say on board, Air Force people don't. At Hurlburt Air Force Base.
The other piece, most special operations require non-soft support. Although we are executing soft missions, we can't do that without all the partnerships around the Panhandle, but also just around the Air Force and DOD.
And that was the theme of the day, is the partnerships between commercial and, civilian, obviously, but, you know, non-military folks and government, and the things that they can do to help the military mission or hinder it if done poorly. But again, what exactly happens at Hurlburt?
This wing has grown immensely. We have about 23,000 people on base. We're the home to Air Force Special Operations Command. We have 40 tenant units. And then we have a wide range of aircraft, from the gunships to U-28s to MC-130s and to armed overwatch that really will be growing at Hurlburt Field as we tend to replace the U-28. We also fly remotely piloted aircraft, and we have some exquisite intelligence capabilities on base as well.
Lots of assets fly out of there.
This is really, this is the meat of the mission right here. So MQ-9 Reaper, some referred to as drones, we call them RPAs, remotely piloted aircraft. They are piloted. Those pilots just happen to be sitting on the ground. Next one is the MC-130 Commando 2, soon to be probably the Talon 3 when it gets modified. This is our exquisite lift capability. If there's a SEAL team or a Green Beret team or a Ranger that needs to get to a place, not really detected, we're going to use the MC-130 to the best of our ability.
So think Fat Albert, okay? Fat Albert is a C-130. It's not an MC because that's a multi-mission combat. You also have the AC, which is the attack cargo or attack combat. That's the gunship. But the C, just straight C, is just the regular old C-130. So there's different configurations for different purposes. The MCs are designed to carry troops, like your air commandos, onto target. The Reaper, which is an armed remote operate. It's not a drone technically, because it's remote operated. Attack capability vehicle. Then he talks about some of the other assets they use.
U-28 Draco, one of the pioneers really of the post 9/11 Air Force generation. This was an aircraft that was acquired really quickly, modified quickly, and is overhead virtually every battlefield that we're encountering right now.
It's a surveillance and reconnaissance plane, and if I showed a picture of it to you, like, it doesn't look like anything. Yeah, it doesn't look like anything. It's just a fixed-wing aircraft that they acquired after 9/11. Lots of operational uses for that. The one that perhaps Hurlburt is the most famous for.
And finally, my original aircraft, the AC-130, with the 105 of just...
You look confused, John. Oh, okay. If you look confused, people are confused. So, okay, I gotcha. Anyway, so the one that they're most famous for is the gunships, which they have out in front now at the air park that you can see, right, just off of Highway 98.
And finally, my original aircraft, the AC-130, with the 105 of justice, this absolutely puts...
the 105 of justice. It's an air howitzer, 105 millimeter. If you want to, that's... 6 inches wide? That's a shell. It's an artillery shell in the air, okay?
This puts fear in every one of our adversaries. Many of our ground parties have said to me, and I'm sure to Colonel Black also, there is nothing better than hearing a gunship overhead. In fact, a lot of times when a gunship would be orbiting, the bad guys just go away. They just, you don't even have to fire a shot. And actually that, a lot of times for a gunship person, as much as we like to eliminate terrorists, sometimes just preventing an engagement for our ground pounders, that's as important as shooting.
And there's all different configurations of these gunships. There's Ghost Riders, Spooky Specters, all different ones historically based on what they have in them. If you're not familiar with this, have you ever seen the movie White House Down? And that giant gray plane that flies around and shoots at the White House? That's a gunship. That's what they're talking about. Or you see them around Pensacola. I haven't seen them recently much, but used to see them more often where you'd see a C-130 circling Pensacola, and you're like, but why? Practice? just getting used to the sights, you know, because this is what you do. You circle a target, and you're like, do they have, well, they're not loaded, okay? Don't worry about that. But yeah, I mean, that's what they're doing. And I'm going to indulge for just a second, John, because, you know, military hardware, I get happy about it. But for people who don't know, I told you already the 105 millimeter justice cannon, the air howitzer. I don't have an audio for that because it's kind of a just, you know, and then they reload and it takes a while, but okay. But there are some other weapons that are on board the, I think the Ghost Rider is the current configuration, the AC-130 that they use now. The most common used one, well, there's actually two very common used ones. The one that is at the low end of the millimeter spectrum, it's a 25 millimeter. So think of, you know, a bullet in a handgun is like 9 millimeters or 10 millimeters. This is like 2.5 of those. This is like an inch wide. Okay. The inch wide is the Gau 22. John, do you know what we deploy Gau 22s on?
I hope everything.
Harriers. Oh. Harriers have the Gau 22. You might be familiar with the Gau 8, the burp gun that's on the, the Warthogs.
Okay? The A-10s, yeah.
Yeah, the A-10s, exactly right. Great gun. So the Gau 22, and this is from outside of an AC-130, so it's got the airplane noise in the background, but this is it's a Gatling gun. It's a 5-barrel Gatling gun. That's 350 rounds, 12 seconds of very effective
don't
fire.
Don't they need to practice somewhere? Like, can we go on and
they
press
have a big
button
test range, you know, at Eglin. They practice,
man,
a lot of things, okay?
That would be amazing.
So that's the Gau 22. And in between this, so you have the 105 millimeter, and then you have the Gau 22. In between them, you actually have the thing that gets used the most, apparently. It's the L-60 Bofors. It's a 40 millimeter. So you think of, if you know, like, 40 Mike Mikes are like a grenade you might launch from a rifle, okay? It's, I don't know how else to describe it. It's like golf ball size, okay, is the size, I mean, width-wise. And this one doesn't fire quite as quickly. It's about 100 rounds a minute, but when it's going off, it sounds like this. It's chugging. Those are 40-millimeter rounds on target. So these are the ones where you see cars and tanks and houses exploding at the other end.
That would be so cool.
Yeah. So take out a convoy, take out the terror. And I tell you that because it's cool, but also because this is the stuff that gets deployed out of Hurlburt on one of their platforms, the AC-130J. And now, where are they deployed? Going back to Colonel Deering, because it's, I think, Deering, excuse me, there's no N in the name. Going back to, you know, where they are deployed, everywhere.
At any given point, about 25% to a third of our folks are deployed overseas right now. In fact, yesterday I looked how many countries we are operating in today, and it's 24 countries we are currently deployed to.
So I know we think a lot about NAS Pensacola. I know we think a lot about NAS Whiting Field. Hurlburt people, the 24,000 people on Hurlburt, are deployed to 24 countries now, operating in 24 countries now, right? And can I suggest that there might be more than just that 24, because there are ones we don't say and can't say and won't say, right? Because special operations, they do stuff that's, you know,
covert. Okay, so your local bases are and where this is ultimately going, I'm going to have to talk about it next hour because I'm completely out of time in this segment. The challenges uniquely facing not just Hurlburt, but all of our military installations and their personnel, we should all care very much about this. Partially because of what it means for their interaction with our local economy and our local governments, but also because of long-term, every problem that a military mission encounters is a potential reason to BRAC. Right? Like, just one example. If the base personnel can't find cheap housing, at some point, maybe they decide to move these missions somewhere where housing is cheap. And our economies are completely dependent upon the military. Traffic. If you're deploying special forces, you got to be able to go quick. And if there's an accident on Highway 98 and the road is shut down for an hour and you can't deploy to a mission because of that, because they can't get there, that's a problem. Okay, so that's just a hint at some of the stuff we're going to talk about next hour. But I wanted you to get a sense of what the mission actually is at Hurlburt Eglin and, of course, at NAS Pensacola and Whiting Field.
Good morning, Pensacola. Andrew McKay and the Pensacola Morning News starts right now.
Let's do it.
Any given point, about 25% to a third of our folks are deployed overseas right now. In fact, yesterday I looked how many countries we are operating in today, and it's 24 countries we are currently deployed to.
All right, this is Colonel Patrick Deering. He is the commander, 1st Special Operations Wing at Hurlburt Air Force Base, a home of 23,000 military people. That's amazing. I'd never think of it as being that big, but it really is, operating, as he says, anytime, all over the world, in 24 countries that we can talk about, and about a quarter to almost a third of their people are deployed at any given moment. Now, this was at a military forum that was taking place in Santa Rosa County recently, and it was a very, very interesting forum, because not only for just learning about our local military community, and you know me, I'm an information nerd. I love to learn things, and if I'm learning, I figure you're learning, and we're all learning together. John, has been interesting so far?
Oh, very interesting.
All right, I'm going to ask you later the things you learned that were the most poignant to you, so we'll do a sum up later. But I really wanted to focus on, and by the way, I learned that Colonel Derrick was formerly the commanding officer of over at NAS Pensacola of the 479th Flying Training Group. That's the one that Seamus Scotto, our good friend over there, oversees right now, that trains the backseaters for the Air Force. So just interesting how all these things connect, how all these pieces and these roles kind of connect with each other. Anyway, back to the Hurlburt stuff. And this is, to me, where it gets very interesting, sort of politically, strategically, thinking about problems that they encounter.
These are the three things where I will ask for your help, both the community and also just the elected officials. Number one, the traffic congestion on Highway 98.
That's a big one for them.
For those who have heard me speak on stage, you know it was coming. I always talk about traffic on Highway 98. Here's why. I mentioned the alert posture that we have. So we really wear two hats with our deployments. One is the habitual deployment where I tell somebody, hey, in 4 months, you're going to deploy to country X, and they go through a spin up, and we know when they're going to go. The other side is our alert posture, which is if there is a national mission that is going to kick off and one SAL is going to participate, we will get hours notice, not days. That entails being able to just go at a moment's notice. And with many of our folks, they will be at home, and we call them and say, come into work right now. We'll give them a couple codes that they know what bags they need to bring. We'll put them into some type of preparation, and then they'll be gone hours later.
So within hours from call down to call up, okay, the response time is a key factor here. And there are regular deployments where people know months in advance or weeks in advance, and that's one thing. But he's talking about these, emergencies, these immediate response problems. And again, Hurlburt sits right on Highway 98. It's, if you don't know the area, that's the one where you kind of drive up and over, and you can look down to the north, and you can see the old gunships there, and then you pass through the airfield. It kind of goes right across Highway 98. You know, if you've just if people who don't know the area, but again, 23,000 military members, many of whom live in Santa Rosa County in the Navarre area and around. And again, we'll get to into all of that, but here he's talking about Highway 98 and the significance of that as a military strategic infrastructure component.
Since I've been in Wing Command, we have launched off of alert. I'll keep it this unclassified, but we've done it numerous times in the last 18 months, several times.
I like how he didn't give a number. He's like, I just won't give a number because I don't want to give out information, right? But you got to figure dozens of times, okay, in 18 months at least, okay?
Additionally, we've had a number of fatalities on Highway 98, not to mention just the normal gridlock of heading out to Navarre or heading into town. And so here's what I hope. I hope I never have to call General Conley and say, sir, the mission failed because of a traffic jam. I'm good with the enemy getting a vote, and they're better than us on a particular day, or we make a tactical error. We don't want that to happen, but if that happens, hey, that's Murphy's Law. But I never want to call General Conley and say, we launched late because of a traffic jam. We have to solve this, and we have to start now.
If you're going to deploy the AC-130s and the U-28s and the Reapers and MQ-9s, the people have to be able to get from their house to the base. And if Highway 98 is shut down, how do you get hundreds or thousands of people at 5 in the morning or 4 in the afternoon to the base? Well, you can't. That's what he's getting at. And he doesn't ever want to get the call from General Conley that he's got to deploy and him to have to call back. We can't do it.
These problems will not go away under my tenure. In fact, I will be retired sitting in a rocking chair when this is solved, but we have to do something now. The only wrong answer is to do nothing.
Yeah, and I mean, just to make the point more poignantly,
the impact that a single fatality had about 6 months ago shut down Highway 98 for about 6 hours. If something bad would have happened in the world in that six-hour period, I would have called General Conley and said, hey, sir, you need to call up to SOCOM headquarters. We are going to miss this mission because Highway 98 shut down for 6 hours. And that was one fatality that happened at 3 o'clock in the morning. And at 10 o'clock that morning, traffic finally started to at least move a little bit.
See, when we're talking about it being slow going on 98, it's mission inconvenience most of the time. But when you're talking about an emergency, it's mission criticality. And so, you know, he knows this can't be solved today. We didn't get here today. We're not going to get out of it today. But he's highlighting the absolute necessity of finding alternatives and solutions to this problem because, again, remember, any base can go anywhere. Hurlburt doesn't have to be here. But our economy and our people and our dear love of what the military does on our behalf, we want it to stay. But if this particular problem and some of the others he's going to talk about get to be too bad, hey, somebody can find another place to stage the AC-130s. Now, they want to be here because the people want to live here, but you get the problem, okay? We're talking about the traffic issues around Navarre.
This is a heat map of where our people live at Hurlburt Field. When I got to my very first gunship assignment, January 2nd, 2002, I lived in Navarre with my wife and one kid at the time. I would set my cruise control from Navarre to Hurlburt Field, and I would cruise control in, and I didn't have to touch the brake until I got to the gate at Hurlburt, unless that one light turned red between Navarre and Hurlburt Field. Local guys know the light I'm talking about. When I say that to our airmen now, that I was on cruise control driving from Navarre to Hurlburt Field, they're like, cruise control? I'm like, guys, it was a 12-minute drive. 12 minutes from Rosewood to Hurlburt Field. 12 minutes. Now it's about a 40-minute drive in the morning.
And by the way, this is not just a matter of the inconvenience from traffic and the mission. That's also part of it. But it's also a matter of how far away people have to live because of the connection with the housing crisis, which is also a problem because housing is a big issue.
Second point is the affordable housing. It's not just a military challenge. It's just a challenge to everybody in this local area. If you're a 28-year-old with a spouse and a couple kids and you need to buy that starter home, it's really hard to do right now. And so I do value the partnership we have with Eglin and with our civilian partners, but the housing crisis, it's very real and we're feeling it here.
And because of the changes in population, building, construction, traffic, all of that, housing is driving people to live farther and farther away from Hurlburt. And that creates its own set of problems.
Hurlburt Field, in 2002, you only lived in Navarre, Fort Walton Beach. Maybe Niceville was the other side of the world. Holly by the Sea was the Pacific Ocean.
In distance.
If you lived in Holly, you were way out there, 30 minutes away. Holy cow. Now we have people living in way out in Pensacola. I don't know how they do that. Crestview, there's affordable housing in Crestview. And a lot of our airmen, you see that heat map, there's a lot of folks living in Crestview. We have people living in Baker, Jay. I talked to somebody who's in Dofuniak Springs.
What?
Because that's where they can find affordable housing. And so I honestly believe this. If we want to solve the traffic issue, it is linked to the housing issue.
Amen.
If we have more affordable local housing, it also will reduce strain on the roads and vice versa. If we fix the roads, people can live further out. So I just put this heat map. People are living all over the place because they're just trying to find a safe place to live.
So if you fix the roads, then you make it more easy for people to commute if they have to from a distance. But if you make more affordable housing in close to the bases, you actually fix the traffic problem because instead of having, you know, 24,000 people making 20-mile trip average, okay, you have 24,000 people making 2 or 5 mile trip average commute, and that reduces congestion on the roads because you have far fewer trip miles occupying your streets every single day of the week. I mean, that you see how these things are all connected. So number one is the Highway 90 traffic. Number two, housing. Number three?
The third thing is access to childcare. I am incredibly...
By the way, is this starting to sound familiar? You know the things we talk about with the Escambia County Commission? We talk about with the mayor all the time. We talk about Santa Rosa County Commission. These are military matters, too.
Upbeat about the discussion that we just had about CDCs on base. That is very real. So envision this. I call
Child Development Centers, CDCs, not the CDC like the disease people in Atlanta. Okay, it's daycare centers, okay?
I call a bunch of squadron commanders and say, hey, we're going. The mission happened. The balloon went up. We need to go help an American in harm's way. They're going to come into work. What they have to do is drop their kid off at school. And we have a ton of dual military families, a ton of them. If that balloon goes up and we have to launch off of alert, they need to take their kids to the CDC, and it may be at 2 o'clock in the morning. Because, again, the enemy doesn't just operate Monday to Friday, 8 to 5. That CDC needs to be under our command, where I can say, open the CDC at 2 in the morning. If we're relying just off base, I lose that flexibility to do it at 2 in the morning. And so, again, I will just thank our elected officials for emphasizing this, and I appreciate the partnership on it.
And remember, as Eglin has recently gone from 3 to 2 facilities, I don't know the status of Hurlburt's CDCs, but you get the issue. If you have multiple military families and kids and you got to have a spin up at 2 in the morning, well, somebody's got to turn the lights on and take care of the kids if they're both military connected to the mission, right? So childcare, Highway 98, which is a readiness issue, of course, housing, and then childcare, housing, Highway 98. And then the fourth one was mental health resources. That was the last one.
The last thing I have is access to mental resources. And when I first took wing command and within the couple months, I had three priorities: housing, traffic, childcare. And in about the last 6 months, I've added one more. And that is mental health resources for our families. We really need help with this. This is not just an Air Force or Hurlburt issue. This is a DOD issue. But it's really for our families. And I think it was hit on earlier. When we send people out the door to go do the nation's business, we're leaving families back here. And I'm very confident that if I have some mental health challenges, I have all the resources I need because I wear a uniform. And I can go on base and get a ton of help, and I'm grateful for that. However, our families don't have all the resources they need.
Right. And working on that, and even with TRICARE, is not necessarily enough, and do they even have access to it? So I just wanted to give you kind of a picture. These are some of the issues because the military mission is vital to our economy. We, of course, love the fact that we are able to support our military mission here in all the different dimensions of it, from Air Force testing at Eglin, from deployment of special operations at Hurlburt, from training pilots at Whiting, or training everybody. 60% of your naval forces and marine forces come through NAS Pensacola at one time or another. And thinking about their problems because their problems are our problems, and solving their problems because their problems are all problem are our problems. And in fact, one of the other comments that I thought was particularly interesting was Tim Kinsella, and I mentioned this to the mayor just a minute ago, but Tim Kinsella, I want you to hear it from him.
You heard it from the colonel about the difficulty of 98, of the traffic there, about childcare. Childcare is a chronic problem throughout the United States. In 2018, the Secretary of Defense, along with the Secretary of the Army, the Air Force, and the Navy, sent a joint letter to the National Governors Association. And in that letter, they said, when you're looking at what's important to the military and where their bases are, so you know that dirty word BRAC, where there's no BRAC going on here, but essentially, if you read between the lines, what they were saying is, you need to pay attention to what's happening outside the wire. What are the things that they're concerned about? Number one was education. Education for their children. Number two was spousal employment. And number three was housing. Those are the things that you can control and that you take care of. Your military families are often the canary in the coal mine. They're the ones, military families live right on the cusp of crisis all the time. They don't know when their families are getting deployed. They're either brand new to an area or they're getting ready to leave an area. Or if they've been here for a year, they're worried about their mission. They're worried about supporting their spouse who's on the front lines and leaving. Military families consistently live right on the edge of crisis. So that means that their needs are much more immediate than your average citizen.
And the point is that if you can worry about them and help them and solve their needs, you wind up solving the problems that everybody suffers from. So I think this, it was eye-opening to me, not just about what the military does here in some dimensions, but also about the significance of solving their problems and all the dimensions of the problems that we can help work on that make a difference for us and them both as we work together in partnership in this community.